Winner of Britain's Forward Poetry Prize in all three categories over the years, Robin Robertson's expansive work includes echoes of his childhood in Aberdeen. The son of a Church of Scotland minister, he was also familiar with the rough and tumble parts of the Scottish fishing and oil town on the North Sea.
I think for everybody, the first 12, 14 years of one's life are formative. And if you are brought up in a place like Aberdeen, that what you're aware of more than anything is the weather and the landscape and the sea and the mountains behind. So this was my playground.
He also discusses the richness of the Scottish vocabulary and the impact of folk stories on his poetry, and reads from his book of selected poems, Sailing the Forest, including the Forward Prize winner for Best Single Poem in 2008. For New Letters on the Air at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, I'm Angela Elam, and here's the second half of the interview with Robin Robertson while he was a guest at Rockhurst University's 2015 Midwest Poet Series, conducted by New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart.
I wanted to ask you about growing up in Aberdeen. Was that a particularly rough neighborhood that you were growing up in?
The Aberdeen I grew up in was at that time a thriving harbor city. The fishing industry was very important. It was the mainstay of the community. And this was before the oil came to Aberdeen, which was another thing altogether, which did make it even more frictional, shall we say. It's always been a hard city, very cold, very wet. And when men are out in trawlers for 3 to 4 weeks, when they come back to shore, they want to have a drink, and they quite often then want to have a fight. And so, yes, there was always an underlying tension.
I've read somewhere that on your way to school, you would walk by a slaughterhouse in order to avoid another route to school where you would get beat up if you went the particular way.
Yeah. That was very valuable, because each time I went past the slaughterhouse, I would look in, move in a little bit further, and the slaughtermen got used to me, and I would go up deeper into the slaughter works and see the hanging carcasses. And it was fascinating. You know, it was like going to an art gallery for me.
You know, you speak of the sailors in there, and you have one particular poem that I wanted to get you to read. I remember the line from it that I love so much. It was, "The drink storms through them." It's the fisherman's farewell. Where was that locale in particular?
Well, this is about all Scottish fishermen.
Yes.
I mean, these ones, I think, probably are West Coast Hebridean fishermen. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. They're all the same. I was trying to get at this sense, which I think is true for fishermen all around the world. They occupy a special distance. They're so used to being out on the ocean, they quite often become uncomfortable on dry land, and there's a kind of dislocation. The sea has become their true element and home, and land seems like a kind of paralysis to them. And so I was trying to get at that. And of course, when they do come back to land, they drink themselves into a sense of watery oblivion. This is called The Fisherman's Farewell. Their long stares mark them apart, eyes gone to sea colours, grey, foam-flecked, and black in the undertow, blue as the blue banners of the mackerel whipping west. On land they are smoke walkers, where each stone is a standing stone, every circle a stone circle. They would be rumour, if they could, in this frozen landscape, like a stopped sea, from the great stone keels of Callanish to the walls of Dunnottar and Drum. They would be less, even, than rumour, to be ocean stealers, to never throw a shadow, to dream the blank horizon and dread the sight of land. The drink storms through these men, uncompasses them, till they're all at sea again. Their houses heeled over in the sand, each ruin now, a cairn for kites. And down by the quay, past empty pots, unmended nets and boats, this tiny bar where men sleep upright in their own element as seals. And that's, of course, how seals sleep, with just their noses coming out of the water, like bottles bobbing.
That's a great image at the end of that poem. That was Robin Robertson reading The Fisherman's Farewell from Sailing the Forest. This is New Letters on the Air. The other thing that I notice about that poem in particular, and it might sound a little nerdy to some people to talk about this, but the quality of the verbs in that poem, in many of your poems, if not most of your poems, are really exceptional. And it seems to me that that either comes instinctively to you or you really reach for it, because you have even the verb storms to refer to the way the drink affects them, but then followed by encompasses them. And I see this in so many of your poems. Is that something that you're working at, you're terribly conscious of? Because the diction in your poems is fascinating too, which I want to ask you about.
I'm not a very adjectival writer, right. I suppose. I think that the verb is underused and can express a great deal more than it does mostly. So it has a real tensile strength and a muscularity that I like. It has movement in it.
Exactly. As an editor myself, I see a lot of manuscripts that come through that are submitted for publication. Oftentimes the verbs are just so flabby, and so to-be verbs and helper verbs and all this stuff, where people really aren't trying hard enough or not caring enough about the language sometimes. And so it's one of the things that made reading your poem so exciting for me, at least as an editor. And there's another poem that I think of alongside of The Fisherman's Farewell. And this is a poem about other drinkers, but it's a poem called The Long Home from an earlier book. But I want to ask you to read that too, because there's something that I want to comment on.
This is one of the poems about Aberdeen and one of my favorite bars in Aberdeen, which is, I will reveal now exclusively, is called the Prince of Wales and has the longest bar counter in Scotland, apparently. And it's a famous place for day drinking, which is the serious kind, as you probably know. And this is a true story about one of these grave day drinkers that I encountered. And the Long Home is a Scottish euphemism for the grave. It might have been the name for the pub, after all. The Long Home. I hadn't been back in 20 years, and he was still here, by the fire, at the far end of the longest bar counter in Aberdeen, some say Scotland. Not many in, and my favourite time, the dog watch. The city still working, its tortoiseshell light just legible in the smoked windows, and through the slow delay of glass, the street lights batting into life. The firewood's sap buzzing like a trapped fly, the granular crackle of a green final folded and unfolded, the sound of the coals unwrapping themselves like sweets. He only looked up when the barman poured a bucketful of ice into the sink, like a tremendous burst of applause. He was drinking sweetheart stout and whiskey, staring into the glass of malt as if it were the past, occasionally taking a pull on the long brown bottle. I remember him telling me with that grim smile, "I'm washing my wounds in alcohol." I like to drink too, but would always leave before him, walking home as if on a wire. I'd heard what had happened, but wasn't ready for the terrible wig all down at one side, the turn in his mouth and his face's hectic blaze. He'd left here so bad he could barely stand. He'd got through his door, back to his room, and passed out for the night, sleeping like a log with his head in the fire.
Robin Robertson reading The Long Home from his book Sailing the Forest. I'm Robert Stewart, and this is New Letters on the Air. That poem provokes me to ask about these poetic images. I keep wanting to tell listeners to this radio program, it pays you to read the poem on the page, because sometimes the image goes by so fast, and it's just stunning. For example, the sound of coals unwrapping themselves like sweets. You know, I think, okay, let's say that 10 times before you really get the power, the freshness, the interestingness of that image. Or walking home as if on a wire. And of course, the final line of this poem, like a log sleeping with his head in the fire. I see that all through your poems. You have a particular amazing skill with the poetic image, and it does a lot of work, which substitutes for the exposition that other people might want to use. Did this come just from reading or from any particular aesthetic or any particular love that you have for poems that you've known over the years?
Well, I think so much comes from reading, of course, but as much comes from just experience, just watching and listening. While I've been here in Kansas City, I enjoy just sitting down and listening and watching people. And things can just hit you by surprise, and you can just write them down. And you just got to pay attention. That's all you need to do.
Right. There's a poem, a sonnet called Crimmond. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that poem.
I'm a son of the manse, which means my father was a Church of Scotland minister. And this is a sonnet which is addressed, or at least dedicated, to Jessie Seymour Irvin, who was also a child of the manse. She was the daughter of a Church of Scotland minister, Alexander Irvin. And she, as a teenager, wrote the tune Crimmond, which is the standard setting for the 23rd Psalm. And Crimmond is a fishing village just up the coast from where I was brought up. And I love that part of the country. And I was fascinated by this young woman writing this beautiful air. And so I just then started thinking about my own father. I should say that Fairy Liquid, I don't know if you have it here, is washing up detergent. And my father, because dog collars, the clerical collars, were so expensive to buy from clerical outfitters, he would just cut up the empty bottles of plastic washing up detergent.
It's very interesting that that image also sits almost right in the center of the poem. It's kind of a break in the...
It's the volta.
In the poem. Everything else is so elevated. Then you come to this dog collar cut from a plastic bottle of fairy liquid. It's just great.
It takes its title from the tune, Crimmond. Daughter of the manse of Dunotter, then Peterhead and Crimmond, all northeastern edges over unstill waters. What softness brought this tune from your young hands? The tune my father called for every Sunday, the 23rd Psalm. When I hear it now, it's all wet cobbles and the Har rolling in down the street outside and him shaking their hands, sharp in his black and white. The dog collar, I knew, cut clean from a bottle of fairy liquid. How far we all are from where we thought we'd be, those parishioners all vanished long ago. My father, ash above the crematorium, me swimming back crawl through the valley of the shadow of death, and you, not even a photograph left of you, the girl who will never touch again the foot of the cross at Crimmond.
Crimmond by Robin Robertson from his collection Sailing the Forest. This is New Letters on the Air. It's a great poem, and you have a couple of sonnets. You don't necessarily rhyme all the time. You rhyme sometimes.
I rhyme internally.
Yes.
A lot of half rhyme, and I don't want to hobble myself unnecessarily with rhyme schemes. I don't really see the point of it. except some people tell me it's very useful if you set yourself a discipline. You can find the poem going in an interesting way as a result. I'm fine with writing basically free verse, but that has a kind of internal sonic structure.
There's a kind of sound quality, even in poems that don't have rhyme in it. There's this sound of the language, you know, the vowels and the consonants and so on. And there's another poem in particular, maybe another sonnet, Wedding the Locksmith's Daughter, which also has a lot of this sound, very highly lyrical, of the quality of the language. Of course, that's what poetry is, but I think it's exceptional in so many of these poems. Now, a lot of poets will talk about the sound or the rhythm and the sound and the lyricism of a poem being what's most important to them about a poem. How does that work in your approach to poetry? Is it the imagery? Is it the story? Is it the lyricism? I suppose everything has to be there, but do you have a particular approach to poetry that is more important?
Honestly, I try not to think about it too much because the thinking about it impedes the writing of it. As you say, you have to have all these things in concert. And my particular fondness is for a kind of dense, impacted, tactile language that still has, I have tried to write in a musical score so that the way that the poem is displayed on the page is the only way that you can read these lines. And through the end stopping and enjambment and the stanza breaks and so on, and the punctuation. So you set up a score. I mean, it's an act of the unconscious. I mean, so little of this is planned. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to be writing. I write out of curiosity, and I like, you know, as Paul Clay said, taking a line for a walk. I'm taking a line of words for a walk. And to see what happens, to see where my imagination, where this all these subconscious threads are going to draw me. In this case, it was slightly taken out of my hands. It's one of the few examples when I was commissioned to write on a subject, and the subject was a locksmith's shop. So I dutifully went off and read as much as I could bear about locksmithery and did find out some interesting things and some handy words and phrases which appear in this poem. But I wasn't interested in the actual act of making locks and keys. I then thought, well, there are some similarities between locks and keys and the business of writing and reading a poem, how a poem is a kind of secret machine that can be unlocked. And that was satisfying for a while. And then my mind, as a young man, turned to more carnal matters. And that was the third aspect to this troubling poem. It's called Wedding the Locksmith's Daughter. The slow-grained slide to embed the blade of the key is a sheathing, a gliding on graphite, pushing inside to find the ribs of the lock. Sunk home, the true key slots to its matrix, geared, tight-fitting, they turn together, shooting the spring lock, throwing the bolt. Dactyls, iambics, the clinch of words, the hidden couplings in the cased machine, a chime of sound on sound, the way the sung note snibs on meaning and holds. The lines engage and marry now, their bells are keeping time, the church doors close and open underground.
Wedding the Locksmith's Daughter by Robin Robertson. I'm Robert Stewart. This is New Letters on the Air. I love the internal rhyme, and whenever I talk to people about rhyme or poets about rhyme, the real trick for contemporary poets, I think, is to use rhyme in a way that it isn't so noticeable.
Exactly.
And also the sound of the snug note snibs on meaning, and it just carries you like on a wave forward through this poem. Did you put it into a sonnet as a device because it was an assigned poem?
I think more because it needed to have a real shape and an accuracy of a defined accuracy, because it was talking about locks and keys and the precise mechanism that is required for them to work in conjunction. So I thought form was crucial, really, to this.
And landscape in particular is extremely important to you. I think I read somewhere that you said it was freighted with meaning for you. And I don't know if you were referring strictly to your original Scottish landscape or to any particular place you might travel to.
I think for everybody, the first 12, 14 years of one's life are formative. And if you are brought up in a place like Aberdeen, that what you're aware of more than anything is the weather and the landscape and the sea and the mountains behind. And so this was my playground, was this 9-mile beach and huge park with a River Don flowing through it and going into the highlands and hill walking. So these were the colours in my palette, and I didn't grow up in a city, and I'm glad I didn't. So I'm, I suppose, attuned and attentive to landscapes of that kind and interested in the difference between them and the ones in my head.
Is there a particular poem in here that maybe catches that sense of the landscape?
The landscape of Scotland.
Of Scotland. The poem that I'm thinking of is At Roan Head.
Well, that's certainly embedded in the landscape of the Northeast, and it's one of my favorites anyway.
And it's a horrific tale in some ways, and yet made through language strangely engaging and beautiful in its own way. I mean, I keep coming back to this level of diction that you inject into these poems, the s'more of fire and, you know, the scratch of day.
These will be unfamiliar words perhaps to your listeners, but to s'more the fire is to smother the fire, to just keep the ashes going through the night so it won't flame up. That's a Scottish word. And scrake of day is just the first glimmer of sunrise. And, you know, herpling and chittering, these are just words that I used in my vernacular as a child. And I found when I moved down to London, you know, I would say, use one of these words, and people would look at me blankly and say, what on earth do you mean? And I found myself losing my own language. I would hold myself back from using Scottish vocabulary, and I hated that loss. And so I called my third book Swithering in spite, just because it's a wonderful word and nobody in England understands it. But it's that sense of very violent uncertainty. I am swithering between life and death. You know, I'm choosing between these two. In my poetry, I try and cherish some of these extraordinary words, which, you know, anybody can look them up. It's not complicated.
And that's one of the great things about the printed word as opposed to the oral, in my opinion anyway, because you can look at them and you can see them and you can absorb them and you can look them up. You can linger on it for a while, and I think that's incredibly important.
I don't think they're unclear within the context. I mean, you can sort of figure out what's
not
going
at all
on.
Yeah, exactly. Let's read it then.
It's one of a series of invented Scots folk narratives that really have something in common with the Celtic folk tradition, in that they're everyday stories of murder, rape, insanity, and physical damage. And this is a poem that draws on those old stories and a particular myth of the Selkie, which you can look up for yourselves. This is called At Roan Head. You'd know her house by the drawn blinds, by the cormorants pitched on the boundary wall, the black crosses of their wings hung out to dry. You'd tell it by the quicken and the pine that hid it from the sea and from the brief light of the sun, and by Angus, the collie, lying at the door where he died, a rack of bones like a sprung trap. A fork of barnacle geese came over with that slow squeak of rusty saws, the bitter seas complaining pool and roll. A whicker of pigeons lifting in the wood. She'd had 4 sons, I knew that well enough, and each one wrong, all born blind, they say, slack-jawed and simple, web-footed, rickety as sticks. Beautiful faces, I'm told, though blank as air. Someone saw them once outside, hurpling down to the shore, chittering like rats, and said they were fine swimmers, but I would have guessed at that. Her husband left her, said they couldn't be his, they were more fish than human, said they were beglamoured, and searched their skin for the showing marks. For years she tended each difficult flame, their tight, flickering bodies. Each night she closed the scales of their eyes to smoor the fire. Until he came again, that last time, thick with drink, saying he'd had enough of this, all this witchery, and made them stand in a row by their beds, twitching. Their hands flapped, herring eyes rolled in their heads. He went along the line, relaxing them, one after another, with a small knife. It said she goes out every night to lay blankets on the graves to keep them warm. It would put the heart across you, all that grief. There was an otter worrying in the leaves, a heron loping slow over the water when I came at scrake of day back to her door. She'd hung four stones in a necklace, wore four rings on the hand that led me past the room with four small candles burning, which she called the Room of Rain. Milky smoke poured up from the grate like a waterfall in reverse, and she said my name, and it was the only thing and the last thing that she said. She gave me a skylark's egg in a bed of frost, gave me twists of my four sons' hair, gave me her husband's head in a wooden box. Then she gave me the sealskin, and I put it on.
At Roan Head, winner of the Forward Poetry Prize for Best Single Poem in 2008, and now included in Robin Robertson's collection Sailing the Forest, selected poems from his previous five books published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. To hear the other half of this conversation with New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart, recorded while Robertson was in Kansas City for Rockhurst University's 2015 Midwest Poet Series, visit our website, newletters.org. The Scottish poet explores post-World War II LA in his 2018 Roehampton Poetry Prize winning book, The Long Take. This poetic narrative is also longlisted for the Man Booker Prize as a debut novel. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter, and sign up for our free weekly podcast. Today's show was produced with Jamie Walsh, Renita Johnson, Morgan Hudson, Cameron Morse, Anders Carlson, Abby Jamison, and Nick Shea. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.